Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Japanese Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Takeshi Morisato. Today, I'll be talking to Wojon Jo, who is the author of The Cinema of Ozu Yasujirō, Histories of the Everyday, a book that was just published in 2017 by Edinburgh University Press. Hello, Wojon.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to talk to you about your new book on Japanese film, and especially your insight into the works of Ozu Yasujirō, the master, Ozu. But before getting into it, I would like to start with a question about you. Could you introduce yourself by telling us about your career, research, and also how you are involved with this field of Japanese and film studies?
Yes. Well, my name is again Wojon.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
Yeah.
Perfectly fine. I'm originally from South Korea, but now I'm working in Nagoya University in Japan. I've been researching here since 2013, so about more than 7 years now. And before that, I was doing postgraduate study in UK. Actually, University of Warwick in UK, where I received my PhD in film studies. And Ozu Yasujirō was my, well, the topic at that time. So I wrote my PhD thesis on Ozu, which evolved into this monograph, The Cinema of Ozu Yasujirō, Histories of the Everyday, published in 2017. And I was interested in, I got interested in Japanese cinema a long time before that, actually, when I went to America, where I first watched some Japanese cinema, and Ozu was a part of it. I watched Late Spring Tokyo Story, of course, and I was very, very, very impressed by the quality of those two pictures. So gradually, I thought about, well, studying about Ozu, and that led into the postgraduate study in UK.
Mm-hmm. So the birth of this book, how you came to write this book is because of your postgraduate study, and even before that, your encounter with Ozu's movies, and then that's how you came to write this book. Okay. So... This is really a fantastic book on the film of Ozu.
Excuse me. Thank you.
But because of that, I have so many questions, and I think it's quite an inspiring book for me, even as a philosopher. But the first list of questions that I would like to ask is this. This book provides this very comprehensive analysis of modern Japan, extending from 1920s to 1960s, both as the background and the foreground of Ozu's works, with this notion of the everyday, which is in the title of the book, The Everyday. Can you tell us more about this importance of this term, everyday, and also how does Ozu use this conception of the present or everyday you know, simply, was it merely descriptive or kind of reproduction of what we go through every day? Or does it have any element that we may call prescriptive or even fictional? That's something that deviates from our mundane everyday.
Right. So I think I have to combine the questions together. One is about the everyday itself. And the other, I think, is about, how it was conceptualized by Ozu when he made the film. Firstly, about the everyday itself, Ozu is quite well known for the director of the everyday. In Japanese, it's called Nichijou. But we can think about it in two separate ways. One is about the subject matter he dealt with in his films, and the other is how he dealt with in his films. So the first thing, the subject matter, is the everyday life of the urban Japanese during the 1920s and 30s until 1960s when Ozu died. So he always dealt with his everyday life of the ordinary Japanese people. Here, the everyday means things that happens at usual and repetitive pace. In terms of time and also in terms of space around nearby places. So it's just, it happens around us, the ordinary people. Though this definition actually have a little bit of danger of generalization because when we say Japanese people, it means all. Does it mean all the Japanese? Of course not. Ozu dealt with a very particular kind of Japanese people. It could be class, it could be gender, it could be generation, it could be, anything. So we have to be very careful when we understand the everyday of Ozu's, that it's not very, it doesn't cover every day that happens in Japan. It could be very particular type. Or specific kind of everyday. And the second thing about how he dealt with that everyday in his film, it's about, I think it can be about aesthetic quality or style, film style. And this was has been quite well known in Western countries by Western scholars. They said, we can see very empty or static or silent kind of time space in Ozu's films, where it seems nothing actually happens. So these was became kind of represent tentative kind of terms for the style of Ozu's films, which is quite true in a way, but I also think. Well, although looking empty and static in appearance, Ozu's films articulate also fullness and liveliness as well. We can see it in his mise-en-scène. We can find it in his editing and narrative, etc., etc. Simply put, I would say there are actually a lot of things happening in his narrative. Daughters are marrying, fathers are worrying about dying, getting old, families are reacting with each other, etc., etc. And in order to show that, we see a lot of characters are moving here and there. So if you see from that kind of perspective, it's not static at all, even though some parts look slow and static. So my book sort of discussed these two aspects of everyday, like subject matter and style, that has been talked about in many Ozu studies so far, but I would like to approach it from a little bit different kind of direction. And the question about the descriptive or prescriptive, I found it this is a bit difficult kind of question. But I would say, in the sense that he sought after the basic ideas and materials to build images and stories from the surrounding world, I think his notion of the everyday can be a very descriptive work. He kind of build up the everyday, getting materials from the surrounding of his world, which is Japan, of course. But it could be a very kind of descriptive work. But on the other hand, there is another kind of different layer of Ozu's representing the everyday, which is sort of kind of constructive way. He not only just gathers those materials around, but he builds it in a very special way, kind of very peculiar type of way. So it looks like he already had a certain kind of rule in his head, and he so he made up all those pieces together in his quite peculiar way. So I would say that's a kind of prescriptive way going around together with the descriptive way. So would that be a kind of answer to
that? Yeah. So it's almost like he seemed to be, describing his almost like his personal experience of every day. But at the same time, his works seem to have a certain methodology that incorporates certain method. For instance, I read some article of his use of uchiwa, the fans in Tokyo Stories, the Tokyo Monogatari. He very specific ways in which he describes the use of the tools, like everyday tools, for instance. So he seemed to have that sort of layer of, a kind of method that gives a signature to his work. Yeah.
Yes. He kind of has already has his formula inside his head and tries to fit the materials he found inside that kind of formula.
Right.
That's kind of his way of the everyday, I think.
Yeah. Another question that I would like to ask in relation to this notion of everyday is this question of modernity. So your book makes it clear that Ozu's film can play an amazing role as a case study of Japanese modernity. And I think it does show this fantastic motion from the 20s to 60s, like as his film director, and he's depicting the everyday. But can you tell us more about this? These past criticism of his works that disagree with your presentation. For instance, his peculiar everyday is negligent of social political issues, including class struggles or issues of individualism. And I can see that some critics would be, labeling Ozu toward a sort of nationalist right wing 1930s, 40s dictum. But I think your book shows a little bit more complex and different view of his work.
That's right.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. In my book, I did conclude that Ozu was very conscious of the issue of Japanese modernity on its very changing nature and also contradictions made against Japanese tradition. So he was very interested in this contradictions between modernity and tradition in his films. And I think he did his best to sort of kind of balance these two different areas of history. But there was a lot of actually criticism from film critics of his times, who criticized Ozu's lack of clear political stance toward the contemporary issues of Japanese society. So, for example, he was active from 1920s. So in the early days, like during the 1930s, in Japan, there was kind of, the boom of tendency films, sort of kind of proletarian kind of films. And there were these Marxist critics who said Ozu lacked sincere kind of intent to articulate class conflicts and contradictions. So that was one. And in the post-war, after the war, after the Second World War, there were other group, group of critics who I think they were more sort of kind of social realists, who strongly criticized that Ozu kind of hid away from various social and political issues at the time, such as poverty and war devastation, and the relationship with the U.S., etc. Those are the sort of kind of criticism towards Ozu. But I took a more positive position in evaluating Ozu's role as a kind of social commentator, if not social realist. I think he did that role through keeping his own way, that is, dealing with the everyday. For example, I mentioned the Marxist critics in the 1930s, and he criticized the Ozu's depiction of urban white-collar families. But it's from the viewpoint of the Marxism, proletarian realism. But what Ozu kind of depicted in his films in the 1930s actually is the middle class, urban middle class. So actually, I think the point is quite different. I would even say the criticism was slightly out of focus. So definitely the middle classes lack the kind of activism of the working class. But we can understand that maybe that could be the essential nature of the middle class themselves. And Ozu kind of show them as kind of feeble, opportunistic, and kind of sentimental beings, the middle classes in the 1930s. But we can maybe you can understand that's actually a faithful representation of that class, the class consciousness that the middle classes had at that time. So by viewing, by showing them in that way, Ozu kind of trying his own way of representing the reality of the 1930s through those middle class everyday. So yeah, there goes my defense for
right. So that perhaps he's actually shedding light on this reality of middle class from perspective that is quite different from these preconceived Marxist framework, basically. And it actually shows the different ways in which we could actually look at the 1930s and middle class. For instance, if you look at his film, tentatively mentioned this static style and emotion. And one of the things that really struck me outstanding in your book is this sort of analysis of space. I like to talk about this use of space in the works of Ozu. There's something really amazing about this, first of all. It's so complex and well thought out. And, you know, despite the style of his filming, for instance, like if you watch his film, each character is shot from the front when they talk to each other. So you have this very straightforward, staccato of character talking, and sometimes he doesn't move this perspective at all. Like you're looking at the entire household from one angle, but he creates so much movement according to your book, and I think that is a great analysis. Can you tell us more about like Ozu's use of space and why this is important for appreciating his works?
Yes. I think this is a very interesting question for me because I was quite interested in the analysis of Ozu's space in my book. Many scholars so far have sort of interpreted his space as being kind of static, repetitive, and even restrictive. And I can understand that why, because... as you mentioned, his camera usually, when he shows character, He usually took the angle from directly in front of the character. So making the object, the character in this case, look very flat, right? There's no angle in this space. And if you remember Ozu's typical domestic shots, it's kind of same. They are divided into several overlapping layers of squares or rectangles, and they are overlapping each other. So it's like looking at a kind of grid, or like a prison, if you may. So it's very flat and rigid kind of space, I would say. It could be also expressed as being two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional. And it's very geometric spaces. I suppose these unique images must have something to do with Ozu's strong interest in graphic design. He left some kind of design works of his own. There was actually exhibition in Tokyo several years before, and I could see them, those works. I could understand why Ozu liked this kind of two-dimensional kind of images, because he made film like drawing, kind of design.
Right, it's almost like a still life of each character is almost like, yeah.
Yeah. So it became very unique kind of image, but depending on what kind of perspective you have, you may see it. It's not fit for cinema. Maybe you may want to say it's not cinematic kind of image because it's too flat. So that's one side that has been well known so far regarding Ozu, but Ozu's space. But I also emphasize in my book that this is not the whole of Ozu's spatial qualities. There are moments when those static flat images or rigidness suddenly break open, through which different rhythms and spatial orders are created. So without these kind of breaking open, his films would just look like avant-garde experimental film, because there is no movement. There's only kind of flat images after flat images. So it must be very boring to watch, but definitely it is not so. So there are actually movements, there are changes of those kind of rigid kind of space, and I can find it in many scenes like parks, playgrounds, restaurants, corridors, amusement park places. In those kind of spaces, characters tend to make more live motions and sounds to generate a kind of rupture within otherwise rigidly configured space. So I think there are two different kinds of space, maybe. And, well, one is well known, but the other is produced by the dynamics between that kind of rigid space and characters together. How he throws those characters into this space and how he makes them move around and generate story and narrative, etc.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. So there's static, but also there's a kind of motion that he creates out of that static. And I do have questions about the perspective or angle that very peculiar to his work later on. But I'd like to move on to this question of his works in post-war, World War II. So his post-war films, you mentioned this really one of the most, probably one of the most important philosophical concepts today and in many other fields. But you talked about this advancement of female subjectivity in Oz's post-war films. Can you tell us more about the importance of femininity, or the phrase you use is the gender-based order of subjectivity in the works of Ozu?
Yes. Actually, there are different kind of gender order or gender politics going on in between Ozu's pre-war work and post-war work. So there was definitely a kind of change in the post-war Ozu's films. Although there was a hint that this kind of change will come in the post-war, in his pre-war or wartime films. Put it in the simplest way, the femininity in the post-war is closely linked to the idea of the temporal present, which I argue is the essential nature of the everyday. So everyday is like, well, it's everyday. It happens every other day. So tomorrow will be another everyday, and it's ever changing and moving on into the kind of future. But another important point is that the temporal present is not completely separated from the past. Rather, it tries to critically interrogate the past in the context of the present. So the past and the present is intermingled together. And past is interpreted in the context of the present. And the important subject of doing this kind of practice is the female characters of Ozu's, rather than male characters. And of course, in the Japanese context, the point that divides this past and the present when Ozu made the post-war films is the Pacific War, the Second World War. And Japanese women, generally speaking, because they were not in their primary role in joining the war. They were kind of doing the secondary role in the background. So they could have more kind of active position when the post-war finally came. So they were in the position to make revision of that kind of past experience in the context of what they're experiencing in the current post-war Japanese society. And they're in the more advantageous kind of position compared to male characters who are active part of the war. So they were more like, more embedded, I mean, male characters are more embedded in the past experience of the war. They were always kind of thinking about, oh, that was a good time, or they were singing the songs that they liked during that time.
Right, during the war, and yeah, right. Yeah. So there's a kind of failure of masculinity during the war, or the sort of end of that sort of... you know, the Tokyo Story, for instance, as the main character, one of the main characters, the son or the husband that die in the war. So there's a kind of death of masculinity, yeah. and woman takes a different role. But, you know, this is my second question in relation to this question of femininity. It's the difficulty of watching Ozu so when we watched his post-war films as a contemporary audience, and whether or not this we comes from Japan or outside of Japan, it's very hard to keep us from interpreting them as depicting a typical subjugation of women in a patriarchal society in East Asia. So if you watched Tokyo Stories or Late Spring, we have a tendency to look at them, look at the femininity depicted in Ozu films as very negative. But your analysis seems to say that the opposite is the case. And your answer to the first question of femininity seems to suggest as well. Can you elaborate on this point? So the non-negative depiction of femininity in Ozu films.
Yes. Well, actually, thanks for asking this question, because I was actually, I had kind of problem kind of analyzing the femininity in relation to what has been being said about those female characters, especially in the West. So it is actually not a surprise to interpret the way you have just mentioned. And for example, a British critic, there's a film critic called Robin Wood. He came to my mind first. He had this idea that, all these female characters are sort of kind of subjugated by the patriarchal society. I think this is a very kind of subtle issue, and you can argue in different ways according to which kind of standpoint you take, based on which cultural, historical, or moral standard you have. So Western viewers would understand from their own point of view, from their own cultural experiences. And Eastern viewers can have different point of view, etc. Or the Ozu's contemporary viewers in the 1950s, for example, can have different perspective from the contemporary viewers now in the 2020s. So it's a very difficult, complex question. But generally speaking, I think I can say that many Ozu's female characters actually have stronger subjectivity than usually regarded. Well, if you think about the marrying daughter characters who are about to marry, who quite often appear in Ozu's post-war films. This is a very well-known kind of narrative in Ozu's post-war films. If you think about them, apart from our common image, most of those young daughter characters actually do not follow what their fathers ask them to do. They either just ignore it or accept only as an alternative choice. So when fathers ask them to, why don't you marry? We have seen that scene very often in Ozu's films. But if you follow the story until the end, actually those daughters do not follow what fathers told them to do. So possibly the only exception is actually Noriko in Late Spring, which I think probably has left a strong impression on Western viewers, including Robin Wood. But I think Noriko is a little bit different. But the other female characters are quite different. Having said this, this is about post-war film. The pre-war films are quite different. Actually, the female characters who are subjugated under, who are suffering under patriarchal rule or power, is these pre-war female characters in Ozu's. They are under severe kind of male violence, for example. they are slapped in their face by their male counterparts, etc. Those kind of things often happen in pre-war films. So it's a little different. But still, I found there are still kind of female solidarity building up in those pre-war films as well. So they are very sympathetic, pitiful kind of characters. But amongst them, among those, between those female characters, they kind of sympathize together with each other. And they mutually understand, show kind of mutual understanding with each other, et cetera, by sort of through their looks, through their touches, bodily movements, et cetera, et cetera. So the hint of these strong female characters are already being suggested in pre-war films as well, too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it finally became more obvious in the post-war film.
Mm-hmm. So much more layers to this sort of a representation of femininity in Oz's work, you know, and also that we would have to assume a little bit of contextualizing viewing from their contemporary time. Now, I'm really interested in this notion of everyday. I'd like to visit this notion again with a little bit more philosophical perspective, if you allow me, because there are so many really insightful references to Japanese philosophy and philosophers in your book. And one of them, actually two of them, really stood out. And one of them is Philosophy of Actuality in Tosaka Jun. So you quoted him and how the Oz's film is in line with his philosophy of actuality to some extent. Now, what's this notion of everyday? So for instance, Oz uses this analogy of his work, I cannot make any more movie than I'm just making a tofu. You know, the famous saying that I can only make tofu and I can make only this simple dish, but I can't make this huge dramatic narrative that describes the era or something like that. But this notion of everyday, you know, you describe it as a kind of intimate universal, both private but omnipresent. It is present to everybody, everyone. And, you know, you have shown us that it can lead us to profound insight into the reality of modern Japan. But also every day has this danger of flattening any dramatic events into, you know, mundane sort of existence. So, for instance, 1930s and 40s Japan, if we pay attention to every day of 1930s and 40s, most contemporary Japanese audience would go, that's the most shocking every day. Yeah. You know, it's indescribable with tofu. Or so is all the tofu is really incapable of describing this dramatic 1930s and 40s and beginning of Japanese modernity? Or is it kind of like a super tofu, you know, can do more than just mundane every day?
Right. I agree that there is a danger that Ozu's everyday can fall into an area of mundanity, as you have just said. It may be true that that's how Ozu's study is so far largely viewed and interpreted him. And they often attached him, his films with such words as mu, it's Japanese, but nothingness or meaninglessness to his films. So in my book, I try to suggest a different point of view from that kind of metaphysical interpretations by discussing more historical or empirical evidences. And you mentioned Tosaka, and Tosaka was one of those kind of philosophers who brought in kind of idea of the concept of the everyday, but from more from a historical or even political kind of point of view, rather than metaphysical kind of interpretation. Well, I've already said that Ozu's everyday is not faithful representation of actual reality, depending on whose everyday he is representing. It's very different. So I have to admit that there actually exists a clear gap between Tosaka's idea of everyday and Ozu's everyday. Tosaka is more, he has this practical method in mind to go against non-scientific, abstract, misleading kind of everyday. And so he supported film's ability to record the world as it is. And he calls that actuality, the film's ability of actuality. And he found the best example of this in documentary or news films, because they try to record the world as it is, although it's actually not true from film scholars' point of view now. Anyway, Tosaka believed in that way. But as we all know, Ozu's films are certainly not documentary or news films. So his vision of the everyday should be distinguished from Tosaka's idea of actuality a little bit. But on the other hand, I also think that that sort of difference does not necessarily mean Ozu's everyday should be pushed into the metaphysical realm of mundanity or whatever. I think it is still based on concrete world of Japanese history and society, and as such, works very well as a kind of social commentary. So you mentioned the metaphor of tofu, which Ozu himself actually directly mentioned. And it was mentioned as a defense of his kind of realism. So during the post-war years, he faced, well, I mentioned this before, but he faced the criticism from social realism kind of critics. They say he was avoiding social ills and conflicts of the post-war. I think he knew that his way of making a film does not suit well with such social realism kind of method. There's a long story behind this, and it's a kind of my personal interpretation why he felt so. I guess it could be from his experience of the war, but maybe if we have time, we can talk about it later. To defend his way of making a realistic kind of film, although it's not social realism or Marxist kind of way of making film, realism film, in order to defend his way, he mentioned this kind of phrase of making tofu. He said, I can make only tofu and not other kinds of dishes. Would this be a kind of answer?
I think that's a really, really fascinating thought to think about.
Just one more sentence?
No, please do.
Because you mentioned maybe tofu might be it's too bland, right? It doesn't have any right. taste. So how can it really express the sort of bitterness of real kind of reality? Mm-hmm. So I think I have to admit that kind of point. So if mm-hmm. we have too much tofu again and again, it may be mm-hmm. actually too bland. So I wouldn't disagree that there goes actually right. a limitation of Ozu's way.
I see. Another thing that I'm interested in, this sort of a limit of what Ozu's films can do and possibly, you know, alleviate some of the unrealistic expectation from us as we watch his works. You mentioned this sort of his resistance toward this exaltation of Japanese spirit in Japanism during the 1930s and 1940s. And then your response to that, the question of, okay, what constitutes Ozu's resistance to this sort of, ethno-nationalist Japanocentrism? And you mentioned something like the positive spirit grounded in every day. Even in the midst of work as a soldier, he was able to find this sort of positivity in everyday life. But he talks about spirit there again. But do you feel there's a sort of tension between these two different kinds of spirit in Ozu's works, or he was able to just say no to this sort of Japanese spirit and able to sort of compartmentalize his existence and happiness within this surroundings.
Right. This is actually a very interesting question. And my short answer could be, to some degree, there is a contradictory aspect in Ozu's everyday, especially in relation to its political meaning. And because this, my quotation, the exaltation of Japanese spirit, it's actually from the wartime. And it was very difficult kind of moment in Japanese history. And there were a lot of sort of different kinds of kind of politics were going on at the time. So when Ozu faced that kind of difficult situation, his notion of the everyday, I think, cannot help but face a kind of difficulty as well. So it can turn out to be very contradictory. It doesn't make sense very well. Actually, the positive spirit. May I explain a little bit about this? Yeah. So he went to war, and he saw a lot of killing and destruction during the war. And for soldiers in the front, this is every day, actually.
Right, yeah, they have to witness that every day, right?
Yeah, every day is murdering people and destroying the buildings, etc. So it's very extraordinary kind of experience. And facing this sort of existential crisis, Ozu, I think, takes up a position to accept the reality as an everyday circumstance and called it a positive spirit. Positive because even if it's murdering or destroying, he can just accept it as it is because it's everyday. To be frank, this is possibly the most difficult part in my book for me to make sense of, because it seems like Ozu approves of the war more than criticizing it, or at least avoiding it. I don't think that Ozu was wholeheartedly supporting the war, or Japanese imperialism or militarism, but at least his thought on the everyday had revealed its contradiction and limitation in front of that kind of unusual scale of disaster like war.
Yeah, right. It seems that he's providing a certain method of resistance. It doesn't look like this sort of dramatic anti-government propaganda, you know, anti-propaganda movement, but it does provide this possibility of focusing on something positive and keeping himself away from that sort of grand narrative of totality. And I suppose we could see that in contemporary Japanese filmmakers as well. But I'm interested in this transition that you mentioned between the pre-war and post-war in your book. And you quoted the famous Japanese philosopher Nishitani Keiji and his notion of the paradox of changing unchanged. So in a way, also represents this continuity before and during and after the war, right? And then we also have this very famous Japanese philosopher and historian, Maruyama Masao, which represents this kind of discontinuity before and after the war. Now, in the field of Japanese philosophy, you know, since you mentioned Nishitani and other Kyoto school philosophers suffer from this severe criticisms, you know, before the World War II, they were not supporting the national spirit and spirit of Japanism. And then after the war, they didn't really, you know, repent and convert their positions from one place to another and then criticize the former regime. They kind of continue their work. How do you I guess my question to you, how would you respond to this type of criticism against Ozu? You know, that made from this perspective of Maruyama Masao or anybody who thinks that discontinuity is the best way to think about the Japanese modernity.
Mm-hmm. Well, the same kind of criticism that Nishitani would have received from, like for example, Maruyama. Yeah, I mentioned Nishitani in my book, but I'm not a philosopher per se, so I'm not in a good position to discuss his philosophy in very detail. But I can answer the question on the basis of the criticism that Ozu received after war. I think there are two different approach to this question about continuity and discontinuity debate. First kind of direction could be historical way, as a historical inquiry, whether post-war Japan was actually a separate kind of entity from its pre-war counterpart. So whether there's historically was there really continuity or discontinuity between pre-war and post-war, that kind of question. I think I mentioned this in my book, and the answer is actually very complex. And according to scholars, the answer can be very different. And Maruyama's point of view is very political. And he was interested in this notion of tennose, the emperor system in Japan. So for him, after the post-war, after the war, there came sort of American democracy, and he saw it as a kind of opportunity to rebuild Japanese society. So he thought it was a completely different system from the pre-war kind of tennose. He wanted to argue that. And on the other hand, Kyoto School had a very different kind of position, as you mentioned. They were more interested in, I would say they were more kind of cultural kind of approach they had. So they were interested in the Japanese modernity in general and its conflict against kind of Western, the Japanese tradition. So they had this dilemma whether Japanese modern or traditional, and they struggled to get over it, etc. So I don't have a clear answer which one is right in this debate, but I can say that Ozu, all I can say is Ozu actually was very conscious about this matter of historical new era of Japan at the post-war. So he was asking himself these questions like, what is Japan? And what was the meaning of the war, the defeated war? And where should the nation go from now on, etc., which is really about Japan and Japanese history, etc. So that's more historical. Historical. Yeah.
So, so he seemed to be doing something with that sort of narrative that tends to break this pre-war and post-war, and his response is quite different from the dramatic reinterpretation of history by Maruyama Masao, and interesting because to me that the film studies and field of philosophy has this sort of a same issue. Like, how do we deal with these masters that are recognized as the great artists or great philosophers, but then they don't seem to have this clear stance toward this historical break. But you mentioned really interesting this sort of emergence of new society after the war, and your reference to later Ozu work. You talked about this distinction between civil society and private society, and civil society is a shimin shakai, and private society is also shimin shakai, but with the private watakushi tami. Now later Ozu works, you suggested that it's a kind of social critique by showing this post-war consumerism or commodity fetishism, to quote your word, as a sort of a new emergence of new Japan or new everyday in Japan. but it's depicted as really boring. Or it's almost like fascinating, but what's the point of that? Now, what was his intention behind that? These films that are, you know, deemed to be less masterpiece than, let's say, Tokyo Monogatari or, right. you know, Late Spring. Yeah,
I see. I think it depends on the viewer's point. I guess. Well, I didn't live in the 1950s or 60s, but I think the Japanese audiences at the time found this quite enjoyable rather than boring, because these Ozu's late films exhibit dealing with this commonality fetishism. Mm-hmm. They were quite popular in box office. It was mostly top three or top five kind of films in those years. Tokyo Story was popular, was good, but these late films were even more popular, very very popular. So I think the contemporary viewers at that time actually understood what Ozu was saying about with this commodity fetishism, because it's not very philosophical or metaphysical kind of notion. He only dealt with it using the everyday object that ordinary people can find around, like refrigerator or television or vacuum machine, which are all appearing, newly invented and appearing in Japanese society at the time. And people had actually craze about buying these new stuffs. So in the context of that contemporary social changes, Ozu picked up on that, those stuffs, and he used it for narrative in his films. And audiences didn't have that hard time understanding that. So I think it was all right for those viewers. It's, however, another different matter whether he, Ozu, had a favorable view of such changes into commodity fetishism kind of material kind of society. I think he was quite... conservative kind of person in terms of accepting those changes, but it's his personal opinion, and I don't think was reflected directly in the film. The film is different.
I see. Okay, so we are reaching quite toward the end, but I would like to ask this just one question on Ozu's work, so that maybe the audience will be able to actually feel like maybe I should watch the Ozu movie again, or if they never watched Ozu, they should probably watch. One thing that bothers me, and I'm pretty sure impressed or bothers other audience, is this sort of low-height camera. It's a signature technique of Ozu film. Can you tell us something about that to make us appreciate this really heavy, low angle camera that is just sometimes it's almost like too close to the ground to the point I feel like really long and really specific technique. Can you tell us something about the value of that technique?
Yes. They say it's around 30 centimeters above the ground.
So from the ground,
pretty low. And it's very famous together with the tofu thing. This is a very famous Ozu kind of style. It's the most well-known reason and effect of using this kind of technique is it suits very well with the domestic lifestyle of Japanese people who tend to sit in the room, inside room. So in order to match the eye line of the sitting character, it's better to lower down the height of camera. That's one very plausible answer, and it's very well-known answer. But it doesn't explain why then the camera is placed at so still so low height outside the house, like in the company building or in landscape shots. I couldn't find Ozu gave any clear answer for this mystery. Although he once said, I don't like the black lines of tatami. That's flooring, Japanese flooring. And there are, lines on the tatami. And if you place camera up above, then those lines will be very visible.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, so if you lower the camera height, then it's not that visible.
It's more prominent. Blurred. The ground is a little bit,
prominent.
I see.
Obvious. So in order to remove those lines, Ozu once said, I sort of place my, I want to place my camera low. So that's another plausible answer. And in relation to this answer, I think this is my personal opinion. I think that low height could be could have something to do with the flatness of image that I mentioned before. Ozu's image is as I said, is two-dimensional. Three-dimensional is not ideal. He wants this two-dimensional image as possible. And if you have high up above kind of camera, then it has angle, then it becomes more three-dimensional than lower height, especially when characters are sitting around. So the characters are in the low height, then it's you want to lower down the camera height too, so that it can be very, very frontal and flat. Right. So this, you can understand this as well when characters stand up, right? Then Ozu does not tilt his camera up above in order to include the standing character's body inside the frame. It will generate angle if he does so. So he rather moves the camera back so that the standing character can be inside the frame, or he just removed the upper body. He just showed the lack of the character.
To show that they're standing, I see.
Yeah, so it's like he wants to keep his frame space, two-dimensional space first, And then onto that space, he just throws the character's body. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So it seems that perspective is the primary, and then all the other characters have to adjust their position in relation to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very fascinating technique, and it's very signature, and I hope our audience will be able to actually enjoy that next time they watch all the movies. Since we're approaching the end of the interview, I'd like to ask you about your plans for the future. So what are you working on right now and maybe ongoing and forthcoming projects? Can you share what you're working on?
Yes. Well, firstly, in relation to Ozu, I'm working on a more fundamental question about his authorship itself as film director, especially in Japanese film culture. It could be an attempt to answer a question like, why do we care about Ozu as filmmaker? Or how do we approach him as filmmaker? Something like that. So my Ozu book definitely is about film director, but I did not consider much about the method, how we should study film director. Yeah, fundamental question. So this is a sort of follow-up kind of research to compensate it. And secondly, I've been also working on an early history of sound cinema, not only in Japan, but also in Korea. Actually, this has also branched out of my Ozu study, because I have discussed about his position, Ozu's position regarding the transition from silent film to sound cinema. So I'm trying to expand this into much wider kind of perspective. That include not only film directors, but also film critics, film industries, audiences, and government policies as well, and compare their views on sound cinema, especially in the early years, in 1920s and early 1930s. So those two are my sort of current project.
Wow, it's really fantastic. It's fascinating. I'm pretty sure once they're published, we will be meeting again and talking about your findings, hopefully in this show again.
Thank you.
Good luck for the forthcoming projects. And thank you so much for talking to us about your book and your incredible analysis of all the films today, Wu Zhong.
My pleasure. It's my
pleasure. Thank you, everyone. It was fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. This was our discussion with Wu Zhongzhou, who is the author of The Cinema of Ozu Yasujirō, Histories of the Everyday. See you next time.